The opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
Greg Roman on WWDB 860 AM with the Middle East Forum Radio Hour. It's a new week, it's new horizons, and a bunch of new news coming out of the Middle East. First and foremost, I think we've been waiting for this declaration for 25 years, since Mahmoud Abbas and Yasser Arafat, Abbas being the now president of the Palestinian Authority, and Yasser Arafat, the former president and chairman of the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, declaring, or at least Abbas is declaring, that he has, and I quote, absolved, as of today, of all the agreements and understandings with the American and Israeli governments. So we have a Palestinian leader who's sitting in Ramallah, scared half to death from half of the people that are ostensibly under his rule, that being the Islamists under Hamas, now alienating the other half, that being the Israelis who are responsible for his well-being in Ramallah, in his compound, the Mukata, which is the presumptive, let's not call it capital, because there's no state of Palestine, but the presumptive headquarters of where he's able to carry out all of his administrative operations. Now here's the thing about why Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, the chairman of the PLO, the president of the Palestinian Authority, has declared. And here's the very basic line here, as reported by Michael Levinson, the Middle East Forum's Washington resident fellow, in a report that came out last night on May 19th, 2020. Micah states that Abu Mazen attributed his decision to Prime Minister Netanyahu's stated plans to annex parts of the West Bank allocated to Israel by the so-called Deal of the Century under the Trump administration, which calls for final status resolution between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and the Trump administration moving its embassy to Jerusalem. Now, here's the rub. The second that Abu Mazen reneges on any agreements that he's struck or that his predecessors struck with the United States, with Israel, with any other party that's in one way or another connected to the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, war process, what have you, their bilateral relationship, and dozens of third parties that are affected by it, this sort of parasitic, in some cases, and in other cases, symbiotic relationship between the two. Abu Mazen is undermining any legitimacy that he has as a leader of the Palestinians. Let's walk through this for a second to get through this logic. Now, Daniel Pipes, the president of the Middle East Forum, about 2 weeks ago, published an article in the New York Times. We talked about this last week, and it continues to have reverberations throughout the discussion and debate on this. But Pipes raised a very cogent point. Not saying that I agree with it, but it merits discussion. And now we see one of these layouts, okay? He said that it would be more likely that the Arab nations, which had been over the past few years, since basically the Obama administration abandoned most Gulf Arab nations and Israel to the Iranians back in the early teens, 2011, 2012, the start of the Iranian process, the Iranian nuclear process. All of the elements of the nadir in relations between Israel and these Arab countries was contingent on an agreement that, you know what, Israel, we want to be close with you because we consider the Arab-Iranian conflict to be of a higher precedent than that of the Palestinians. The Palestinian issue didn't work for us. We had these Arab revolts back in the 2011, 2012, the so-called Arab Spring, and it really wasn't good for us. We kept on blaming our problems on the Palestinians. Well, guess what? The Palestinians are still there. There's still a problem to you guys, at least, and we still have our domestic issues. So they got over their Palestinian obsession, and they started looking at the benefit of bilateral relations or multilateral relations in the terms of the GCC, the Egypt, Jordan, whatever else, with Israel. But now, Netanyahu and his government, his new government, which was sworn in on Sunday in Jerusalem, have come forward, and it's not just the prime minister, but also his new foreign minister and his defense minister, which have advocated for the position of clear and defensible borders by annexing or declaring sovereignty over certain areas where Jewish residents live in the West Bank or Judea and Samaria. And what Pipes said was, you have to be able, or not what he said per se, but what I take as a point of inference from what he wrote, is you have this order of threats that are in the region right now, okay? And he's saying, don't declare your sovereignty or annexation or any other sort of symbolic move in the West Bank, because it will inevitably hurt your relations with these other Arab states that you've now experienced and adhere in your relations with them. Just yesterday, the United Arab Emirates has flown an aid aircraft or an aircraft from Etihad Airlines with aid for the Palestinians. But the strong point here is that it landed at Ben Gurion Airport, the Israeli airport in the middle of the country. The first time there has ever been a flight from the Emirates, the United Arab Emirates, to Israel proper. Not the first time an Emirati visited Israel, but the first time that a state airline flew directly to Tel Aviv. So you have all these developments in the relationship. And Pipes is correct, insofar as these relations are good for Israel, and Israel already exerts control over the Jordan Valley. It already has 500,000 citizens in the West Bank that it effectively rules as if though it is part of the nation state of Israel. Symbolic gestures, in Pipes' opinion, do nothing to move the needle on the ultimate goal, which is the Palestinian acceptance of a Jewish state of Israel, rather than being told where its borders are. So I push back on this a little bit. The argument I made in a few days later in an article in The Hill was that, yes, there has to be a declaration of Israeli sovereignty in areas in which Jewish residents, and Arab Israeli residents for that matter, live in the West Bank, but it should be a land swap. Arab Israelis in the Wadi Ara, which Pipes actually calls probably the greatest strategic threat to Israel in its nature of a Jewish state. So I'm a fan of this land swap, this Avigdor Lieberman idea. Pipe says it's not the right time to do this, and we disagree on the tactics, but we agree on the ultimate goal here, which is to undermine the Palestinian rejectionist narrative, which has prevailed in their society for five generations. And as a result of Netanyahu's declaration that he seeks to declare sovereignty over Jewish areas of the West Bank, of Judea and Samaria, specifically the settlement blocks and the Jordan River Valley, we now have the ultimate Palestinian rejectionist move, which is to reject their own legitimacy as a semi-autonomous governing body from Abu Mazen, from Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, by saying, I don't just recognize my relationship that my authority, not his authority as his sovereign authority, but his Palestinian authority, his governmental entity, his semi-autonomous governmental entity, which has been given control by the Oslo Accords and subsequent agreements over what's called Area A and B, Area A being areas where Palestinians, under the auspices of the Palestinian Authority, have ostensible control of security and civil relations in areas in major Palestinian city centers in the West Bank and in Gaza, and Area B, where they have most of the control over the civil aspects of Palestinians living in those areas, water, electricity, waste disposal, archaeology, health, whatever other portfolios that you would think would be in a local government, they control there with Israeli security control. But because the Prime Minister of Israel declared in his new government's position that he intends to basically extend the symbolic recognition of Israeli civil law rather than that of the Ministry of Defense, which is the current authority in the West Bank, to Jewish residents and where they live. Abu Mazen has thrown the baby out with the bathwater, or in this case, his own legitimacy as president with the agreements that put him there. Some further thoughts in our next interview with Anna Arnheim from the Jerusalem Post. But first, these messages.
Fascism was the danger to American interests in the early 20th century, communism in the last half of that century, and in the 21st century, we find our new ideological enemy, Islamism. Islamist Watch argues that violence is not the only or even the best way to apply Islamist ideas in Western liberal democracies. Islamist Watch monitors and exposes the growing influence of non-violent radical Islamist groups in the West while empowering moderate Muslims. Radical Islam is the problem. Mainstream Islam is the solution. Read more at www.islamist-watch.org or check us out on Twitter at Islamist Watch.
This is a public service announcement test from TakeMeFishing.org to determine if you need a fishing license and boat registration before heading out on the water. Let's begin. Are you a bear? Do you have a beak? Does your name rhyme with Ald Beagle? Do you dart in front of cars? Here's a tough one. Do you have plumage? Do you rub your body against things to mark them? Do you have webbed feet? No, I mean like a... Were you hatched? Do you have fur? I'm not talking back hair. Does your boat fly south for the winter with the other boats? Regardless of how you answered, you need to be licensed and registered because it helps local conservation efforts protect the very natural resources you enjoy boating and fishing in for generations to come. Do your part at TakeMeFishing.org.
Welcome back to WWDB 860 AM, Philadelphia Talk Radio. I'm Greg Roman, your host of the Middle East Forum Radio Hour. We've got a little technical issue. We're going to get to another commercial, and then we're going to be joined by our guest, Anna Arenheim. Back to the messages.
The Israel Victory Project steers U.S. policy toward backing an Israel victory over the Palestinians to resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict. Decades of what insiders call peace processing have left matters worse than where they started. The time has come for a new approach, a complete rethinking of the problem that draws on Israel's earlier and successful strategy of deterrence. Stop pressuring Jerusalem to compromise and make painful concessions. Instead, support Israeli victory, convincing Palestinians and others that the Jewish state will endure. Read more at meforum.org.
Take a look under your bed. Find stuff under there? What about jobs? No? Now try your basement. There's a pair of overalls that, overall, you're not so into anymore. A perfectly good laptop that hasn't seen your lap in months. And even more stuff, but still no jobs? Well, you really have both. See, stuff is defined as household articles considered as a group. Sometimes this stuff is no longer needed. Wait, no longer needed? That can't be right. Because remember those jobs you were looking for? Those are really needed. And they're the stuff inside your stuff. Even inside that winter coat that moved with you to Phoenix. Our job is to unlock those jobs. And it starts when you donate your stuff to your local Goodwill. Here's how we do it. When you donate to Goodwill, we sell your stuff to provide job training for people right here in your community. So just by teaming up with Goodwill, you help create jobs. And isn't that worth parting with the leftover keytar from your 80s cover band? Goodwill. Donate stuff. Create jobs. Find your nearest donation center at goodwill.org. A message from Goodwill and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Middle East Forum Radio here on WWDB 860 AM. I'm Greg Roman, your host. Garrett Gamble here is on the side helping us with some research, and Marilyn Stern, our producer, has set up all the interviews for today. We are joined by Anna Arenheim, a reporter from the Jerusalem Post, and in her better days has now been seen on a tour of both the Lebanese border and of the Golan Heights, according to her Twitter account. And Anna, can you tell us a little bit about your work with the Post and about your most recent trip up to the north of Israel?
Well, I'm the military reporter for the Post. I cover everything about defense, the IDF, the region, the conflict. And I'm actually just returning again from the Lebanese border. I've been going up several times this week. On the one hand, to cover 20 years since the Israeli withdrawal from South Lebanon. On the other hand, to see what has Hezbollah been up to in the past 20 years.
So let's talk about this for a second. Hezbollah and Israel have gone nearly 14 years without a major armed conflict. There's been some tit-for-tat attacks, but no substantial outbreak of violence. How has the battlefield changed since 2006, and what do you think the next war is going to look like?
Well, the battlefield has completely changed on both sides. I would just like to say that there has been significant outbursts of violence between the two. If we look at September of just this year, when Hezbollah fired 3 anti-tank missiles, and one of them almost hit an IDF ambulance, and that was a huge outbreak of violence that we hadn't seen in years. And that just shows the capabilities of Hezbollah, because for close to 14 years, Hezbollah only responded or only attacked Israeli troops in the Mount Dov Sheba Farms area. But recently, Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, said, if you're striking our operatives in Syria, in Lebanon, we're not going to just hit you in the Sheba Farms area. We're going to hit you wherever we want along the border. And that's a significant change. And we can also see, if we look at Syria, they weren't there in 2006. And now there's, you know, the Syrian civil war and all of the battlefield knowledge that they gained from the Iranians, from the Russians. And that is what's going to happen and really affect the next war. We're going to see not just one front, not just the Lebanese front explode, but we're going to see the entire northern front from the Mediterranean Sea all the way to the Hermon. It's going to be one big war.
So let's get specific for a second about Hezbollah's capabilities, and specifically its missile arsenal, that it's improved dramatically, to your point, because of Iranian assistance, compared from 2006 until today, in terms of range and accuracy. And more so, have Israel's air defenses kept pace with these improvements?
Hezbollah is estimated to have around 130,000 rockets of different ranges and payloads, ranges that can even reach Dimona. And that's pretty far from Lebanon, a range that we didn't see in 2006. Now, Israel, of course, like you said, our air defenses have been improving on a year-to-year basis, but it's not ever 100%. So all, if you take the Iron Dome, the famed Iron Dome, the David Sling, the Arrow system, if you take all of these, you're still going to have rockets landing in Israel deep in the home front. Even some the IDF is concerned might be precision missiles, missiles that can hit within 5 meters of the target. And so Israel is very concerned about that. And that's something that they've been working very hard to try to stop those capabilities. Because not only are they working in Lebanon on those capabilities, they're also working in Syria. And there's been a bunch of reports about how Iran has been helping Hezbollah work on that precision missile project. And Israel has been going in with its War Between War campaign specifically in Syria to stop that. And we've seen this campaign really up its ante in the past few weeks in Syria.
Now, that's its air arsenal. What about its ability to strike out at Israel's newfound natural gas supply in the Mediterranean Sea?
It's something that we already saw in 2006 when Hezbollah fired a Yakunt missile towards the Israeli
cruise
Navy
missile.
Ship.
Right.
Exactly. So they had those capabilities back then, so you can only imagine what they might have now.
And the difference is here is that we have they're not mobile. They're stationary targets in the terms of natural gas platforms. And what has Israel done to adjust its naval capabilities to fend off a Hezbollah seaborne attack?
So Israel's new Navy ships, the new SAR-6 missile ships, are going to be armed with a naval Iron Dome. And they're going to be deployed really to protect those natural gas platforms. And the Army hopes that that's going to be the solution. But like I said before, nothing's 100%. So we're probably going to see a mix of both naval Iron Dome usage and as well probably the David Sling, which has a higher range an ability to hit incoming missiles from even from Iran.
And that's land and sea, excuse me, air and sea. But we've recently mm-hmm. seen tens of thousands of Israeli reservists, even during the time of the coronavirus, mobilizing and exercises in the north to deal with a potential land incursion by Hezbollah. What is Hezbollah planning besides the tunnel? I saw you had this amazing picture of a Hezbollah tunnel that had been blown up by the Israelis. One of the issues is that they had tried to go from Lebanon into Israel by way of this tunnel. But what is it doing in general with Israel besides blowing up tunnels of preparing for a potential Hezbollah land incursion?
Well, just to clarify, they didn't blow up the tunnel. That's something that they tend to do more on the Gaza front in Lebanon. And I actually had the chance to go into one of those tunnels. And trust me, they are they're incredible. I've been inside a Hamas tunnel. I've been inside a Palestinian Islamic Jihad tunnel. And nothing compares to what I saw in Hezbollah. And Israel flooded these tunnels with cement in order to prevent Hezbollah from using them. But that was just one aspect of their Conquer the Galilee plan. And Hezbollah, this is what they would like to do, is to conquer the Galilee. But what that means is that they would send in a battalion's worth or brigade's worth of troops, and they have that, and they have them set up like that. They're now referred to as a terror army by the chief of staff here. And they plan to come into Israel, to infiltrate into Israel, not underground anymore, but by land, by cutting the fence or smashing through the wall close to some Israeli communities in order to take over a community or military post, take as many pictures that they can of killing Israeli soldiers and civilians, planting the flag. And for them, that's enough, because the media is going to do the rest. In Israel, if you see pictures of dead civilians or dead soldiers, that hits a nerve. And Hezbollah knows that. And they know that they're not going to come back alive from a mission like that. But, you know, in the 80s or the 1970s, where Hezbollah or other Palestinian terror groups were to infiltrate into Israel and attack a bus or one family, now they're aiming to take over a village. If you look at Metula or Misgav Am, where I was today, they are on the border fence, less than a kilometer or two, and you have Kfar Kile or Adaitse, and those South Lebanese towns are military fortresses full of Hezbollah operatives waiting for the order to infiltrate and kill.
Now, we've spoken about the threat that Hezbollah poses to Israel, but Israel has also been conducting what is called a War Between Wars campaign against Iran's presence in Syria that's been intensifying with airstrikes nearly every week and sometimes every day. Is progress being mm-hmm. made in degrading Iran's strength, or is Israel simply mowing the lawn of Iran's capabilities? And I want to ask you to please comment also on statements made by Israel's outgoing defense minister, Naftali Bennett, and its incoming defense minister, Benny Gantz, where they have now said mm-hmm. that the goal is not to just degrade Iran's capability in Syria, but to eject all Iranian forces from that country.
Right. Now, that's the pushing Iran completely out was the goal from the beginning. They don't want Iran there. They don't want Hezbollah there because they don't want to see southern Syria or all of Syria turn into South Lebanon to be that front, like I told you about, from the Mediterranean to the Hermon. They want the entire area of South Syria and all of Syria wiped out of Iranian forces. Now, the comments made by senior defense ministers and senior officials of Iran withdrawing from Syria because of the war between war campaign. It's a little more complicated than that. The Iranians are in a massive crisis right now in Iran itself. And they're understanding that they're losing legitimacy in the eyes of their own people of being so far away from home. Why are they spending millions and millions in Syria and they can't do that in Iran? So Israel's war between war campaign, which has been going on since 2011, 2013, has definitely been intensifying because they see that the move already by Iran, which has been happening for a few months already, of moving their forces closer to the Iraqi border and of withdrawing from several bases. And they're seeing, okay, well, they're stopping here. Let's see if we can up the ante a bit more and really push them out. At the same time, there are still thousands of Shiite militias that are trained and funded by Iran that are also withdrawing from Syria. And again, it's also because of the civil war winding down in Syria. And the, you know, there's no need for them there anymore. But they're also realizing that Israel is targeting these militias. So in Syria, it's very complicated. It's not just Israel's war between wars, which, yes, has been intensifying over the past few weeks. But it's also, if you look at what happened in January with Qasem Soleimani being taken out by the Americans, that had a massive effect. Qasem Soleimani was a symbol of Iran's regional plans. He was on the front lines. He was meeting with senior officials, even met with Putin a few times. The fact that he's out of the game has made Iran need to rethink their strategy, because his successor is not going to fill his shoes, and Iran knows that.
Now, that's Iran's conventional threat in Syria. But we've also seen in recent months Iran's ramping up of its nuclear program. How prepared is Israel to stop Iran if it races to produce a weapons-grade uranium bomb?
That's something that Israel actually last year put as a number two threat to Israel. It always used to be the number one threat, but then changed it to Hezbollah's precision missile project. That was the bigger threat. But Israel, of course, like we saw in Iraq, in Osirak in 84, like we saw in Syria also with their nuclear program, Israel has no qualms about taking a preemptive strike if being the big word, it deems it to be, you know, a strategic threat. Right now, they're not seeing that yet.
Now, how prepared is Iran to respond militarily to an Israeli preemptive strike?
A preemptive strike on their nuclear program?
Or right.
A preemptive strike
Israel,
on Iranian...
No, to the nuclear program. So Israel decides to carry out a preemptive strike against Iran's nuclear facilities spread out across some 300-odd sites across Iran. How does Iran respond the day after or the moment after the strike is over?
I think definitely we'll see a major attack by all the proxy forces in the region, but not only against Israel. It would also be against the Americans, and that would also be in Iraq. But what Israel is really concerned about is not a preemptive Israeli strike on an Iranian nuclear facility and how would Iran respond. But one little miscalculation by Israel or by the Americans is what is really concerning the Israelis right now, because they think that one little misstep could lead into a huge conflagration, which will, you know, reverberate across the entire Middle East. And it could start in the Gulf of Oman. It could start in Iraq. And in the end, it'll end up here in Israel.
Anna Arnheim, military affairs reporter for the Jerusalem Post. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
after these messages, Ksenia Svitlova.
The Middle East Forum has been promoting American interests in the Middle East for the past 25 years. The forum provides context, insights, and policy recommendations through its premier and most widely read Middle East journal, Middle East Quarterly, publishing debates, public lectures, staff writings, arguments, and coverage of every Middle Eastern country that America operates in. From Morocco to Iran, from Turkey to Djibouti, the Middle East Quarterly is there for you. Read more at www.mequarterly.org.
During the Civil War, it was called Soldier's Heart. After World War II, they called it Gross Stress Reaction. It's been called Shell Shock, War Neurosis, and Battle Fatigue. Today, we call it Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, and it affects one out of every five warriors returning from battle in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's not a wound that you can see, though it can have an even more significant impact. Post-traumatic stress disorder can prevent warriors from living a normal life, hurt their relationships, and affect their ability to hold a steady job. The Wounded Warrior Project offers comfort and support for warriors with post-traumatic stress disorder and all other scars of war, whether those scars are visible or hidden. Find out what you can do to help, because for warriors, the greatest casualty is being forgotten. Please visit WoundedWarriorProject.org.
Welcome back to Middle East Forum Radio here on WWDB 860 AM. We're now pleased to have a pre-recorded interview with Ksenia Svitlova, former member of Knesset, and now a researcher at the Interdisciplinary Center in Israel, speaking about Russia, Middle East affairs.
Lebanon, Syria, Libya, Egypt, and the Palestinian territories. A specialist, she, in 2019, authored her first book, Through Middle East on Heels, the Pardes Publishing House. Ksenia, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Greg. Good to be here.
And thank you for joining us. And we really have to talk right now about news that's developed in the last 48 hours as it relates to the article that you wrote on May 14th, Why the Kremlin is Not Giving Up on Assad, and other murmurs from the Saudis, from the Israelis, from the Kurds to a certain extent, of why Bashar al-Assad's position as dictator of Syria, 9 years after the end of the civil war, may be in jeopardy. What's going on?
Yes, so let me begin from the beginning. A few weeks ago, a surprising survey was published by one of the Russian media outlets that belongs to the so-called Putin's chefs, Yevgeny Prigozhin, an oligarch, a very powerful man, very close man to Putin. And the survey basically said that Syrians do not trust anymore Bashar Assad, and he's unlikely candidate to win in the elections of 2021 that are scheduled for, they were scheduled for April, and now they were removed to June. So for anybody who reads the survey, of course, you know, there are many, many question marks there. So since when do we have a democratic elections in Syria, in which the acting president cannot win? Okay, so this is first. Second, how can you really make a survey now in Syria, considering that, you know, the very pitiful situation in this country? And third, what was the purpose, you know, for which this survey was published by an anonymous media outlet that belongs to this very, very powerful man? So many experts, especially in the Gulf, but I would say that also in the United States, have jumped immediately to the conclusion that this is it, enough is enough, and Russia, that was not infatuated with Bashar Assad from the beginning, is probably, you know, wishes to get rid of him, and probably wants to do it prior to the presidential elections. The problem with this assumption is that, first of all, that in Russia there is only one center of power that acts, you know, in the that has total control of the situation. This is first. And there are, instead of that, you know, I would suggest that in Russia we have many centers of power, and some of them are working to promote their own interests, especially when we are talking about business interests. So Prigozhin has many business interests in oil specifically, but also others in Syria. he was not as successful in promoting them as he would wish. And one of the assumptions is that the survey was summoned by him in order to pressure Bashar Assad for his own benefit, also for the benefit of his master, President Putin. But we do not talk right now at any possibility of exclusion of Assad, removal of Assad from power, simply because there is no substitute for the Russians. They need some source that will give them legitimacy for their presence in Syria. Assad is giving them this, you know, so-called legitimacy, if we can talk about this at all, because he invited the Russians to intervene for him in 2015. It was formal cry for help. And anybody who will replace him will not be, he will not own his life and his survival to the Russians as he does. Okay, so it's a catch-22. With Assad, the Russians cannot rebuild Syria. They cannot improve the economical situation there because everything is stuck. Nobody will help Syria when Assad is there. But without Assad, they lose their legitimacy. So for now, they're stuck with this dictator, a person who is responsible for murdering 500,000 of his own people, exiling millions of others. They understand very well who he is, and they might despise him. But for now, Assad is staying.
Can we go through a checklist of who the Russians have to deal with in Syria besides the Assad family? They've got the Kurds. They've got the Turks. To a certain extent, they have to deal with the Iraqis. And they have to deal with Israel and the Americans. And let's not forget Iran. Why don't you walk through those six parties and the Russian relationship with each one and how that might be affecting their decision of what to do with Assad?
So until now, Russians were extremely successful in having good relations with all the parties that are involved in the Syrian conflict. They were jiggling between the between Turkey and Iran, despite you know, having all of these countries having conflicting interests in Syria. Very good working relations with Israel. Israel, you know, woke up one day and we found out that we became a neighbor of Russia in our northern border, you know. So it was particularly striking for people like me who originally, you know, made immigration, made Aliyah from Russia in the beginning of the 90s. Yeah? So suddenly the country that you left, you're becoming, it becomes your neighbor once again. It worked well until, I would say, the end of autumn 2019. Because the problems began when Russians had to somehow deal with the issue of Idlib in northeastern Syria. This province now has about 3 million people who are, you know, citizens who are just stuck there because they happen to live there. They have all of the representation of all possible jihadists and oppositional organizations who are also, you know, they poured into Idlib because they were just forced, you know, from everywhere else. They are now protected by Turkey. So Russia has to accommodate Turkey concern for having extra 3 million refugees. It already hosts too many million refugees spends a lot of money to taking care of them. This is also the issue of influence. Okay, the Turks would not, you know, be willing to give up their influence in this part of the land. It is strategic for them. They will not go away, you know. So the Russians understood at this moment that Turkey is it will be not an easy party to just you know, have a solution for it. Actually, there is no solution so much for Idlib, and we can see it now. They are going from one ceasefire to another, while the objective, of course, is to regain all of the Syrian land eventually for the Assad family, for the Assad regime. How to reconcile it with the desire of Turks to have this area of domination, also because of the Kurdish issue. I would say that the Kurds were, of course, forced after the, you know, U.S. Withdrawal of forces from northeastern Syria. They were forced to go back to Moscow and to beg for their protection. Okay, so again, a win for Russia. For the Kurds, it's not something new that they are in the position where they have to beg for protection, they have to beg for their lives. Now, there is two other actors, it's Iran and Israel. Okay, so this is a very interesting game that the Russians are playing right now in Syria. They are allowing for the Israeli Air Force, and we are talking about, you know, for them basically not retaliating for any of the strikes that happened during the last month, and there was a serious increase in the strikes against the Iranian and pro-Iranian targets in different parts of Syria. When the Iranians are, you know, coming to them and they're basically accusing them of not operating their systems, the S-300, they're saying that, well, you know, you brought all of the systems, air defense systems, but they are worthless because you do not operate them. You know, you and not the Syrians have the right to operate the systems. So the Russians make themselves as they do not understand, they do not want to really hear, you know, all of these complaints. The Iranians are partners, but they're also rivals in Syria. There are conflicting business interests. There is a lot, you know, what they can fight for in the sphere of also the rebuilding of Syria and also, of course, the energy sector. So when the war is almost over now, okay, so the Russians do not need the Iranians as much as they used to need them. They still are not willing to actively do anything to ban them from Syria. They cannot really uproot them from Syria. It's impossible. Iran is too deeply rooted in the Syrian soil, economically, military. They are moving populations from Afghanistan, from Pakistan, and they are resettling them in Syria. So this is also ethnic cleansing and population exchange. This is what is happening in this miserable country. So, again, this is the, I think, masterpiece of Russian diplomacy. From one side, you know, they are using the Iranians to fight the battles. They do not put as much soldiers on the ground as you would think. It's not a very expensive expedition for them. From the other side, also Israel is happy because, you know, what the foreign media outlets attribute to Israel, all of this activity that happened during the last few weeks, this is happening with full knowledge of Russian military that is sitting in Syria.
Right, but there's also been some rough spots between Israel and Russia. For instance, the downing of a Tupolev 22 Russian military aircraft off the coast of Syria by a Syrian anti-air missile, but ostensibly as a result of a lack of coordination between the Israeli Air Force and the Russian air defense systems on the ground, and the Syrian air defense systems, rather, on the ground. So what are the Israelis and the Russians doing to deconflict any conflict over the skies of Syria?
So I would say that the deconfliction is basically working extremely well. But then again, it's only deconfliction. It's not a cooperation. Israel has one strategic partner in the world, and this is the United States. You know, let me be very clear about it. This is not a O-O game, you know, either, you know, we are going to the United States or we're going now with Russia. There is no other option. Our strategic partner is the United States. We have to, however, have some kind of cooperation in the deconfliction center with the Russians to prevent exactly this type of tragedies that happened last year. Unfortunately, the Russian side decided to blame Israel for the fault of their Syrian clients. It seems to me, because I was following very closely the coverage of this incident in the Russian media, somebody in the defense ministry was particularly eager to have this anti-Israeli, I would say even anti-Semitic campaign that was launched at that moment. And then, you know, it suddenly stopped at once after a few weeks of very vicious coverage and blames and even threats that came from the direction of the defense ministry. Suddenly, when Putin intervened and there was this reconciliation conversation between him and between Netanyahu, the prime minister, suddenly it all was, you know, abruptly ended. So no more, you know, grudges, no more hate, and so on. But, you know, we are not mistaken. We know that if anything remotely of this kind will happen again, then again, you know, even if it will be the fault of, I don't know, Iranians or the Syrian military or whatever, but the Russian soldiers will, you know, suffer. The Russians are very, very clear about it. Okay, so they, it seems that once again, Israel will be held responsible, even if it really didn't help a direct involvement in this kind of incidents. And this is, of course, a worrying, worrying reality. But then again, you know, this is not something that we can change or we can alter. This is the reality. Russia is the dominant power in Syria. It became even more dominant now when U.S. Almost removed all of its forces from Syria. And it will remain there, never mind the COVID-19 crisis, economic crisis that they're facing there. They are not going anywhere. Just to remind you that they chartered the Tartus seaport for the next 49 years. And they're investing now $500 million in reshaping and restructuring this port, so it will also accommodate their needs of their military.
And they never really had a significant naval presence outside of Russian borders, except in Tartus. That was a deal that was signed in the 70s?
Exactly. This is a dream come true.
Right. Now it's a deep water port. They can accommodate, what, like 18 ships of the Russian Navy?
We already see the exercises that they perform close to the shores of Lebanon and to Syria, and it seems that they are about to fulfill the long-time Russian dream since the days of Peter I, and certainly from the days of the Soviet Union, and have their own Mediterranean fleet. I don't know to which part of the Russian Navy it will belong, but this is something that is, it's work in progress, okay? So they already have a word in the Mediterranean. They already have their influence over the course of events that will happen there. And, of course, the proximity to Northern Alliance members and to everything that is going on in Europe, it's extremely important. I think that it's, this point is being basically underestimated because I saw that many American outlets had published since the beginning of the year. You know, Foreign Affairs wrote about it, also Foreign Policy, saying that, you know, the Russian power in the Middle East is on decline. They only just begun. They're, you know, playing a long-term game, and nobody is going anywhere. Although they are not progressing perhaps as quickly as, you know, they would want to, in the Gulf specifically. Also in Egypt, you know, there are conflicting news now about selling the Su-35 jets to
right,
Egypt.
The Sukhoi-35, the equivalent of the fifth generation American aircrafts.
Yes, so Egypt was already notified by the Pentagon that there will be ramifications for this kind of deal, and it was, you know, it seemed that for a while that they are not going to go for this. For this deal, maybe, you know, postpone it or, you know, maybe even cancel it. Now there are some reports also from Russia and unconfirmed reports from Egypt that this deal is proceeding. So if it will indeed it will be accomplished, it will be a clear sign that you know, things are going on. Things are going on, and they are able to basically promote their influence and to project their power in the Middle East.
No, we have a report here from Defense News that the Gagarin aircraft plant in Khamsa-Ask on Amur is starting production as of yesterday, according to the TASS agency. And the Egyptians are on slate to get a few dozen aircraft, 24 aircraft. I wonder how that's going to go, you know, head-to-head with the Israeli F-35. Let's get to a place of personal interest for you for a second. When you were a member of Knesset from 2015 to 2019, you were the chairwoman of the caucus for the strengthening of relations between the state of Israel and the Kurdish people. Less on the Israel side, more on the Kurdish side. How are the Russians dealing with the, how are the Kurds dealing with the Russian presence in Syria?
So, since the beginning of the Russian involvement in 2015, the Kurds, specifically the SDF, they received signals from Moscow. They were invited for discussions. They were inviting for cooperation. And they basically, they were told that at the moment when the Americans will be leaving And at that moment, who could imagine that in 2015, 2016? You will be handling the Turks alone. So, guys, you have to reconsider your alliances. You need us. You need us, or you will need us even more when the Americans will be leaving. And this is exactly what happened. Now, Russians were involved with the issue of the Kurdish struggle for quite some time. You know, there is also substantial Kurdish population in Russian Federation, which is interesting, yes? So, and the Kurds had relations also with the Communist Party during the Soviet time, and they were used as also leverage against Turkey, which was, you know, straight NATO member and ally of the West for many, many years. Until recently. So sometimes this Kurdish card, well, everybody plays the Kurdish card, unfortunately. These people, in my opinion, deserve their state no less and perhaps even more than many, many other people who also are fighting for their sovereignty and really they suffered for so long. I believe that it will be of justice if the state of the nations, they will support their cause regardless of the political game. But this is real life. In real life, you have all kinds of political alliances, and usually it's alliances. In Russian, you say it's against. You have to be friends with somebody against somebody else. Okay, so in this regard, the Kurds were cooperating with the Soviet Union in the 60s and the 70s, less so in the recent years of the Soviet Union. And then again, with Russia, you have this strategic dialogue that is ongoing. The Kurds understand that they are not the favorites. They are not Moscow's favorite because there are not much gains, you know, from cooperation with them at the moment. But again, it's part of the Russian strategy. Keep everybody more or less happy and dependent on you. So the Kurds are exactly in this position right now. They are dependent on Moscow. They have only one address right now in Syria with whom they can cooperate to protect them against the Turks.
All right, we've got about 4 or 5 minutes left here. Okay. The focus of Russia, we've covered Iran, we've covered Israel, we've covered the Assad family, we've covered the Kurds. But what do the Russians get out of a permanent presence in Syria in terms of economic gain? We talked about Tartus and the Air Force Base, which we didn't mention, but they're going to have an air presence there too. What do they get economically from Syria that they don't have right now?
So for now, the Russians are not getting as much from Syria in contrast with what they planned to have. You have a number of oligarchs, and specifically Prigozhin, whom we discussed already, that help the Russian state to be more successful in the wars that it wages in different parts of the world. So specifically Prigozhin, he is an owner of the so-called Wagner security company. And Wagners are fighting along with the Russian soldiers. It's something that Russia doesn't recognize.
Let's just give the audience a real quick history on Wagner. Active in Russia, active in Libya, active in disinformation campaigns against the United States.
Active in Central African Republic, active in many other places in the world where their military and economic interests that Russia pursues, but it doesn't pursue it with the hands of its own military or its own soldiers, but rather with the hands of private people, private security companies that are owned by oligarchs who are very, very close to Kremlin. So in Syria, companies such as Wagner, who lost many, many of their people, that they are talking now, many hundreds of people who are Wagner operatives who were killed in battles, various battlefields in Syria. And the reward should be, of course, it should be rights for exploiting the gas fields, the oil fields. So Prigozhin actually got the rights for the oil field next to Palmyra in central Syria. And he signed that contract in the beginning of this year. It was reported that he signed the contracts in January. But it seems that the Syrian bureaucracy and the kleptocratic regime that is in power and the interests of Iranians, they're all overlapping the interests of the Russian companies. So they are unable for now to extract any value from the contracts that they sign. You have also other oligarchs that have contracts, you know, for other sectors, so phosphates, you know, and other, you know, things that you can find in Syria. And they're all complaining that the gain is not that significant and that they have to compete with the Iranians, who it seems that, you know, being a little bit more successful in the financial sphere than the Russians. Okay, so we are talking basically natural resources. This is what Syria can offer. Nobody is standing in line to rebuild Syria because you need to invest money for that. And who would want to do that at the moment?
Well, think about that for a second. Think about this pipeline, okay? So just as an imaginary situation, the Russians help finish the job at Idlib. They reach some kind of accord with the Turks and the Syrians and Hezbollah and anyone else involved, all the different Islamist entities that are there. And then Assad calls a peace conference or a reconstruction conference. Billions of dollars are raised to rebuild Syria. And here you go, at the front of the line are a bunch of Russian oligarchs and their construction companies, concrete, oil, gas, food, job training, whatever else, waiting with their hands out for basically building the new Syria on the destruction that they caused. It's quite an operation.
It's quite an operation, only nobody at the moment is ready to put even $1 to invest in the future of Syria, because until Bashar Assad is there, you have this united position of also Europe, also United States, the majority of Arab Gulf countries, apart perhaps the United Arab Emirates, they have their own agenda. But they are not willing, and also China. China is important here because China would be the, you know, the immediate suspect of who can put the money. Yes, of you know, this kind. You need $350 billion to regain, you know, Syria, to rebuild Syria. So China is not eager as well. China is not part of those who would want to jump into this infested by terror and myriad of conflicts, ethnic, religious, political conflicts land, and just offer their system. So for now, it seems that until Bashar Assad is there, and I think it was made quite clear last year when the Russians tried to promote through the UN this constitutional committee thing, and to make an appearance of, you know, some political process that is happening in Syria, and was so unconvincing, it was so weak, that I think that many of the countries just made it clear that there is no rebuilding on Syria, there is no effort to invest, you know, money or to do something until Bashar Assad is there. So this is the catch-22 that we were referring to in the beginning of our conversation. Until Assad is there, you cannot really do much. You cannot move the stone that is called Syria today from one side to another. But when Assad will be gone, then also Russian legitimacy might be jeopardized. And this is something that I'm not sure that anybody in Moscow was willing to risk.
Ksenia Svetlova, former member of the Israeli Knesset and senior policy analyst at the Institute for Policy and Strategy at the Interdisciplinary Center in Herzliya. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Shalom.
And I'm Greg Roman here on WWDB 860 AM. We'll see you next week.